Nevertheless, Rusty, we must be honest enough to tell ourselves that the evidence overall is very damaging. Sandy does not pause long, but the words, even though I probably would have said as much myself, feel like something driven against my heart. The evidence is very damaging. We must probe. It is difficult, of course, and I am sure painful, but now is the time that you must put your fine mind to work on this case, Rusty. You must tell me every flaw, every defect. We must look scrupulously at each piece of evidence, each witness, again and again. Let us not say that any of this hard work will be done tomorrow. Best to begin right now, today. The more deficiencies we find in this circumstantial case, the better our chances, the more Nico must explain, and explain with difficulty. Do not be afraid to be technical. Every point for which Delaguardia cannot account increases your opportunities for acquittal. Although I have hardened myself, one word catches me like a blow. Opportunities, I think. Sandy summons Jamie Kemp to take part in our discussion, as it is bound to suggest various motions for discovery that we will soon be called upon to file. To hold down my expenses, Stern has agreed to allow me to assist in research and investigation, but I must act under his direction. With Kemp, I share the work of the junior lawyer, and I have enjoyed this collaboration more than I had counted on. Kemp has been Stern's associate about a year now. As I get the story quite some time ago, Jamie was a guitarist in a medium-popular rock and roll band. They say he went through the whole shot, records and groupies and road shows. And when things went downhill, he decamped for Yale Law School. I dealt with him in the PA's office on two or three occasions without incident, but he had a reputation there for being preppy and stuck up, impressed by his own blonde good looks and a lifetime of good fortune. I like him, though he sometimes cannot suppress a little of that waspy amusement with a world by which, he is convinced, he will never quite be touched. First, says Stern, we must file a notice of alibi. This is a declaration, no questions. We will formally notify the prosecution of our intention to stand by my statement in Raymond's office that I was at home the night Carolyn was murdered. This position deprives me of what, in theory, is probably the best defense, conceding that I saw Carolyn that night for an unrelated reason. That posture would dampen the force of the physical evidence and focus instead on the last of any proof tying me to the murder. For weeks I have been expecting some artful effort by Stern to discourage the alibi, and I find myself relieved. Whatever Sandy thinks of what I said, he apparently recognizes that to reverse field now would be too difficult. We would have to conceive an innocent explanation for my eruption on Black Wednesday, why I went out of my way to lie, in outraged tones, to my boss, my friend, and the two top lawyers from the new administration. Stern pulls the box to him and begins sorting through the documents. He starts from the front, the physical evidence. Let us go to the heart of the matter, says Stern. The glass. Kemp goes out to make copies of the fingerprint report, and the three of us read. The computer people made their findings the day before the election. By then, Bolcaro was playing ball with Nico, and so Morano, the police chief, surely was as well. This report must have gone straight to the top and right out to Nico. So DeLay probably told the truth himself when he claimed that Wednesday in Horgan's office that he had acquired significant evidence against me during the campaign and chose not to publicize it. Too much of a last-minute mess, I would suppose. As for the report, it says, in brief, that my right thumb and middle finger have been identified. The other latent present remains unknown. It is not mine. It is not Carolyn's. In all likelihood, it belongs to one of the initial onlookers at the scene, the street cops who responded to the call, who always seem to run around touching everything before the homicide dicks arrive. The building manager who found the body, the paramedics, maybe even a reporter. Nonetheless, it will be one of the difficult stray details for Delaguardia to cope with. I would like to look at that glass, I say. It might help me figure some things out. Stern points at Kemp and tells him to list a motion for production of physical evidence. Also, I say, we want them to produce all the fingerprint reports. They dusted everything in the apartment. This one Stern assigns to me. He hands me a pad. Motion for production of all scientific examinations, all underlying reports, spectrographs, charts, chemical analyses, etc., etc. You know it better than I do. I make the note. Stern has a question. You had drinks in Carolyn's apartment, of course. When you were there in the past? Sure, I say. And she wasn't much of a housekeeper, but I think she'd wash a glass once in 6 months. Yes, Stern says simply. We are both grim. Kemp has another idea. I'd like to get a complete inventory of everything in that apartment, every physical object. Where's the contraceptive jelly, or whatever it is, that this chemist is saying he finds present? Wouldn't that have been in her medicine cabinet? He looks to me for confirmation, but I shake my head. I don't even remember discussing birth control with Carolyn. I may be male chauvinist of the year, but I never asked her what she was doing. Stern is ruminating, temporizing in the air with his cigar. Caution here, he says. There are productive thoughts, but we do not want to lead Delaguardia to evidence he has not thought to obtain. Our requests, whatever they are, must be unobtrusive. Remember that everything that the prosecution discovers which favors the defense must be turned over to us. Anything we discuss which might be useful to them will be better left forgotten. Sandy gives me a sidewise look, quite amused. He enjoys being so candid with a former opponent. Perhaps he is thinking of some specific piece of evidence he kept from me in the past. Best we conduct this search ourselves without disclosing our intentions. He points at Kemp. It is his turn. Another motion, then, for an inventory of all items seized from the apartment of the decedent, and for an opportunity to conduct a view and inspection of our own. The apartment remains under seal, he asks me. I presume. Also, says Stern, your mention of Carolyn's personal habits leads to this thought. We should subpoena her doctors. No privileges survive her death. Who knows what we might discover? Drugs? Rope burns in the past, says Kemp. We all laugh, a grisly moment. Sandy, decorous as ever, asks if the name of one of Carolyn's doctors is known to me. It is not, but all county employees are covered by Blue Cross. A subpoena to them, I suggest, is bound to uncover a good deal of information, including doctors' names. Stern is pleased by my contribution. The next group of documents we look at are the phone records from Carolyn's home number and my own, an inch-thick bundle of Xeroxed pages with an endless train of 14-digit numbers. I hand the sheets one by one to Stern. From my phone, there are 1-minute calls to Carolyn's recorded on March 5th, 10th, and 20th. When I get to April 1st, I spend a long time looking. I just lay my finger on the number that is recorded there at 7:32 p.m., a 2-minute call. Carolyn's, I tell him. Ah, says Stern. There must be a common-sense explanation for all of this. Observing Stern work is like tracking smoke, watching a shadow lengthen. Is it the accent that allows him to lay that perfect subtle stress on the word must? I know my assignment. He smokes. You do what at home when you babysit? He asks. Work, read memos, indictments, prosecution packages, briefs. Must you confer with other deputy prosecuting attorneys? Occasionally. Of course, says Stern. Now and then there is the need to ask a brief question, schedule an appointment. No doubt in all these months of records, Stern taps them. There are a number of such calls to deputy prosecuting attorneys other than Carolyn. I nod with each suggestion. There are a lot of possibilities, I say. I think Carolyn was working on a big indictment that month. I'll look over some things. Good, says Stern. He looks back at my mud sheets for the murder night. His lips are rumpled, his look disturbed. No further calls after 7:32, he says finally and points. In other words, no proof that I was home where I say I was. Bad, I say. Bad, Stern finally says aloud. Perhaps someone called you that evening? I shake my head. None that I remember. But I know my lines now. I'll think about it, I say. I take back the mud sheet for April 1st, studying it a moment. Can those things be dummied up? Asks Kemp. The muds? I nod. I was thinking about that, I say. The PA gets a bunch of Xeroxes of the phone company's printouts. If a deputy or somebody else wanted to do a job on a defendant, he could make a great cut and paste and nobody would know the difference. I nod again and look at Kemp. These things could be faked.
And should we pursue that possibility? Asks Stern. Is there some hint of rebuke in his voice?
He is studying a thread pulled on his shirt sleeve, but when his eyes light on mine for the briefest instant, they are penetrating as lasers.
We might think about that, I say at last.
Says Stern to himself. He is quite solemn. He points at Kemp to make a note.
I do not believe we should explore this before the conclusion of the state's evidence. I would not want to see them introduce the fact that we made efforts to challenge the accuracy of these records and failed.
He directs this remark to Kemp, but it is clear to me who is meant to catch its import. Stern reaches resolutely for another file. He checks his watch, a slim golden Swiss piece. The arraignment is in 45 minutes. Sandy himself is due back in court sooner. He suggests we talk about the witnesses. I summarize what I have read thus far. I mention that Molto and DeLaGuardia provided no statements from two of the listed witnesses, my secretary Eugenia and Raymond. Sandy absently tells Kemp to list another motion for production. He has put his glasses back on, tortoiseshell half frames, and continues studying the witness list.
The secretary, he says, does not trouble me, for reasons I will explain. Horgan candidly does.
I start when Sandy says this.
Certain witnesses, Sandy explains, DeLaGuardia must bring to the stand, whatever their disadvantages to him. You know this, of course, Rusty, far better than I. Detective Lipranzer is an example. He was quite candid in his interview with Molto the day after the election, and acknowledged that you asked him not to order your home telephone records. That is sufficiently helpful to the prosecution that Lipranzer will be called, notwithstanding the many fine things he will say about you personally. Horgan, on the other hand, is not a witness whom I would think a good prosecutor would ordinarily be eager to see. He will be known to all the jurors, and his credibility is such that it would seem quite risky to call him unless...
Sandy waits. He picks up his cigar again. Unless what? I ask. Unless he is going to be hostile to the defense? I don't believe Raymond Horgan will put the bricks to me. Not after 12 years. Besides, what can he say?
It is a matter of tone, not so much as content. I take it that he is going to testify to your statement in his office on the day after the election.
One would think that Nico would be better off putting on Ms. MacDougall if he had to accept an unfriendly witness. She, at least, has not been a local personality for more than a decade.
On the other hand, if it appears that Horgan, DeLaGuardia's political opponent and your friend and employer for 12 years, is sympathetic to the prosecution, that could be extremely damaging. That is the kind of courtroom nuance on which you and I both know close cases often turn.
I look at him squarely. I don't believe that.
I understand, he says. And you are probably correct. Probably there is something we have missed that will seem obvious when we know Horgan's prospective testimony. Nonetheless, Sandy thinks.
Raymond would meet with you?
I can't imagine why not.
I will call him and see. Where is he now?
Kemp remembers the law firm. About six names. The League of Nations. Every ethnic group is mentioned. O'Grady, Steinberg, Marconi, Slibovich, Jackson, and Jones. Something like that.
We should plan a meeting for Horgan, you and me, as soon as possible.
Strangely, this is the first thing Sandy has said that is both entirely unexpected and whose effect I cannot seem to shake. It is true that I have not heard from Raymond since that day in April that I walked out of his office. But he has had his own concerns, new job, new office. More particularly, he is an experienced criminal defense lawyer and knows how circumscribed our talks would necessarily have to be. His silence I had taken as a professional accommodation. Until now. I wonder if this is not simply some malicious effort by the prosecutors to unsettle me. That would be like Molto.
Why does he need Raymond to testify, if he intends to call Molto, I ask.
Principally, says Stern, because Molto is, in all likelihood, not going to testify. De La Guardia has referred a number of times to Tommy trying the case. A lawyer is prohibited from being a witness and advocate in the same proceeding. Nonetheless, Sandy reminds Jamie, that we ought to file a motion to disqualify Molto, since he is on the witness list. If nothing else, this will promote consternation in the PA's office. And it will force Nico to forswear any use of my statement to Molto. Like me, Sandy considers it unlikely that Nico would really want to offer this in the prosecution's case. As De La Guardia's best friend and chief assistant, Molto would be too easy to impeach. But on the other hand, the statement could be used effectively in cross-examining me. It is best, therefore, to file the motion and force Nico's hand. Sandy moves ahead.
This I do not understand, he says.
He holds aloft the statement of the maid, who says she saw me on a bus into the city from Nearing on a night near the time Carolyn was murdered.
What is De La Guardia up to?
We only have one car, I explain. I'm sure Molto checked the registrations. Barbara took it that night. So I had to have another way to get to Carolyn. I bet they had a trooper standing out at the bus station in Nearing for a week, looking for someone who could make my picture.
This interests me, Stern says. They apparently accept that Barbara indeed left you at home that night. I understand why they would concede that she took the car. There have been too many unfortunate episodes with women around the university for anyone to believe she would be using public transportation at night. But why agree she left at all?
No prosecutor would want to argue that the defendant rode a bus to a murder. It does not sound authentic. They must have found nothing with the taxi companies and rent-a-car. I take it that they are looking at records of some kind which confirm Barbara's absence. Probably the login sheet at the U, I say. Nat and I have gone to watch his mother work on the computer on occasion. It'll show she used the machine. She signs in when she gets there.
Ah, says Stern.
What time would that be? Jamie asks. Not late, right? She'll know you were home at the time of the murder, or at least that she left you there, won't she?
Absolutely. Her computer time's at 8.
She leaves for the U, 7:30, 22, the latest.
And Nat? Asks Sandy. When is he in bed?
Around then, most of the time. Barbara gets him down before she goes.
Kemp asks, does Nat get up a lot or does he sleep soundly?
Like a coma, I say. But I'd never leave him alone in the house. Stern makes a sound. That is not the kind of thing we will be able to prove.
Nonetheless, says Stern, these facts are helpful.
We are entitled to whatever records they have.
That is Brady material,
evidence favorable to the defense.
We must make another motion. Fiery and outraged. A good assignment for you, Rusty.
He smiles kindly. I make the note. I tell Sandy there is only one more witness I want to talk about. I point to Robinson's name.
He's a shrink, I say. I saw him a few times.
Molto, I'm sure, is behind the ugly gesture of naming my former psychiatrist as a potential witness. Tommy is pulling my chain. I used to do things like that to defendants. Make sure they knew I'd been all over their lives. Last month, Molto subpoenaed my bank account in Nearing. The president, an old friend of Barbara's deceased father, Dr. Bernstein, will not look at me now when I come in. From my checks, no doubt, Molto got Robinson's name. I am surprised by Stern's reaction to my disclosure.
Yes, Dr. Robinson, Sandy says. He called me right after the return of the indictment. I neglected to mention that.
He was too decorous, is what Stern means.
He had seen my name in the paper as your lawyer. He merely wanted me to know that he had been identified and that the police had attempted an interview. He was reluctant to trouble you with his information. At any rate, he told me he refused to make any statement on the grounds of privilege. I reaffirmed that and said we would not waive.
We can waive. I don't care, I say. I don't either. Seems like a minor intrusion compared to what has taken place in the last few months.
Your attorney is ordering you to care. Delaguardia and Molto are no doubt hoping we will make a waiver, in the belief that this doctor will testify to your general mental health and the unlikeliness of criminal behavior.
I bet he will.
I see I did not make my point, says Stern. I commented before. Evidence of motive here is weak. You summarized Delaguardia's theory very ably, I think. Savage is obsessed, you said. Savage is unwilling to let go. Tell me, Rusty, you have looked over Delaguardia's case. Where is the proof here of any prior amorous relationship between the defendant and the decedent? A few telephone calls that can be accounted for by business needs? There is no diary here, no note that came with flowers, no lover's correspondence? That, I take it, is what your secretary will be called for, to add what she can, which I assume is not very much.
Very little, I say. Sandy is right. I did not see this hole. As a prosecutor, I would never have missed it, but it is harder when you have all the facts. Still, I battle back a light-headed sensation of hope. I cannot believe that Nico could be weak on this essential. I point at the mud sheets. There are calls to my home from Carolyn's in late October last year.
Yes?
And who is to say they are not from Ms. Polhemus to you? You had been lawyers on an important case that was tried the month preceding. No doubt there were continuing developments, bond questions. As I recall, there was a substantial dispute surrounding custody of the boy.
What was his name?
Wendell McGaffin.
Yes, Wendell.
These are matters to which the chief deputy might have difficulty giving attention in the office. And why did I tell LaPranzer not to get my home phone tolls?
More difficult, Sandy nods. But I take it for granted that a person of innocent state of mind would rule himself out as a suspect and prevent a busy detective from wasting his time.
The way he puts things, I take it for granted, like sleight of hand. Mrs. Kropotnik, I ask, alluding to her expected testimony that I was seen around Carolyn's apartment.
You are on trial together. Matters needed to be discussed.
Certainly, if you want to get away from the Kendall County PA's office, a most dreary environment, you are not going to go out to Nearing, where you live. No one denies you were in the apartment on occasion. We agree. Your fingerprints are on the glass.
Sandy's smile is Latin, complex. His defense is taking shape, and he is quite persuasive.
No, Sandy says. Delaguardia cannot call you, of course, or presumably your wife. And so he faces difficulties. Tongues, no doubt, have wagged, Rusty. I am sure half the attorneys in Kendall County now believe that they suspected your affair, but gossip will not be admitted. The prosecution has no witnesses, and thus no proof of motive.
I would be more hopeful, Sandy says, were it not for the problem of your testimony.
His eyes, large and dark, deep and serious, briefly cross my own. The problem of my testimony. The problem, he means, of telling the truth. But these are questions for the future. Our job, after all, is merely to raise a doubt. And it may be that when Della Guardia concludes his case, the jury will be led to wonder if you are not the victim of a miserable coincidence. Or if I was set up. Sandy is a reasonable man and judicious. He again acquires his grave look in response to my proposal. He would obviously prefer that there be no illusions between client and counsel. He glances at his watch. It is getting close to showtime. I touch his wrist. What would you say if I told you that Carolyn seems to have had something to do with a case on which a deputy PA was bribed? And the PA in the case was Tommy Molto. Sandy takes a very long time with this, his look tightly drawn.
Please explain.
I tell him in a few moments about the B file. These are, I explain, grand jury secrets. Until now, I have preferred to keep them to myself.
And your investigations led where?
Nowhere. It stopped the day I left.
We must find some way to continue.
I would suggest an investigator ordinarily.
Perhaps you have some other idea?
Sandy puts out his cigar. He grinds the stub down carefully and looks at it an instant, reverentially. He sighs before he stands to put on his coat.
To attack the prosecutor, Rusty, is a tactic that is almost always pleasing to the client and seldom convincing to a jury.
These matters I mentioned before, your political opposition to Della Guardia, your firing of him, are items that will tarnish him, diminish his credibility. They will help us explain the prosecutor's zeal to accuse on insufficient evidence. But before we venture down the road to actual accusation, we must consider the matter very carefully. Successes by suggesting sinister motives in the state are, as you well know, quite rare.
I understand, I say. I wanted you to know, I tell him.
Of course, and I appreciate that. It's just, I tell him, that's the way I feel. That it isn't a coincidence it lays out this way. I mean, and now on sudden impulse I finally bring myself to say what vestigial pride has so long prevented. Sandy, I'm innocent.
Stern reaches over, and as only he could do, pats me on the hand. He has a look of deep, if practiced, sadness, and as I meet this brown-eyed spaniel expression, I realize that Alejandro Stern, one of this town's finest defense lawyers, has heard these ardent proclamations of innocence too many times before.
Chapter 19. At 2:10, Jamie and I meet Barbara at the corner of Grand and Filer and advance with her to the courthouse. The press horde is waiting for us on the steps beneath the columns. I know a back entrance through the heating and cooling plant, but I figure I can use that trick only once, and I've had the dismal thought that there may come another day when I am particularly eager to avoid this clawing mass with their halogen lights, their boom mics, their shoving and their shouting. For the moment, I am content to push my way through, saying no comment. Stanley Rosenberg from Channel 5, splendidly handsome except for particularly prominent front teeth, is the first to reach us. He has left his camera person and sound crew behind and approaches me alone, walking beside us. We address each other by first names. Any chance you'll do something on camera?
None, I answer.
Kemp already is trying to intervene, but I hold him off as we continue walking. If you change your mind, will you promise to call me first?
Not now, Jamie says, and lays his hand on Stanley's sleeve.
Stanley, to his credit, maintains his good humor. He introduces himself and makes his pitch to Kemp instead. Right before the trial, Rosenberg says, a broadcast interview with Rusty would be good for everybody. Stern will never let me make statements to anyone, but Kemp, as we approach the steps and the waiting crowd of cameras, lights, and microphones, says merely, "We'll think about it." Stanley remains behind as we start up, Kemp and I flanking Barbara, more or less boosting her by the elbows as we shove our way through. "What do you think about the fact that Raymond Horgan is going to testify against you?" Stanley shouts as we are parting. I pivot quickly. Stanley's bad teeth are fully revealed. He knew he'd get me with that one. Where does that come from, I wonder? Stanley may have made assumptions upon reading the court file where Nico's witness list was filed, but Rosenberg has long-term connections to Raymond, and instinct tells me he would not use Horgan's name loosely. The cameras are barred by judicial order inside the courthouse, and as we swing through the brass revolving doors, it is only the print and radio reporters who follow us in a pack, thrusting out their tape recorders and shouting questions to which none of us respond. As we hurry down the corridor toward the elevators, I reach for Barbara's hand, which is around my arm. "How are you doing?" I ask. Her look is strained, but she tells me she is fine. "Stanley Rosenberg is not as good-looking as he appears on TV," she adds. "None of them is," I tell her. My arraignment is before the Honorable Edgar Mumphrey, Chief Judge of the Kendall County Superior Court. Ed Mumphrey was leaving the PA's office just about the time I began. He was regarded with a kind of awe, even then, for one reason. He is very rich. His father opened a chain of movie theaters in this town, which he eventually parlayed into hotels and radio stations. Ed naturally has labored to appear immune to his fortune's influence. He was a deputy for almost a decade. Then he entered private practice, where he remained for only a year or two before the call came to the bench. He has proved a straight, capable judge, short just enough candle power to keep him from being regarded as brilliant. He became chief judge last year, an assignment which is primarily administrative, although he hears all arraignments and negotiates and takes guilty pleas when they are offered in the early stages of proceedings. I take a seat in Judge Mumphrey's dark, rococo courtroom in the front row. Barbara is beside me in a fine blue suit. For reasons that baffle me, she has also chosen to wear a hat, from which descends a coarse black mesh, presumably intended to suggest a veil. I think of telling her that the funeral is not yet, but Barbara has never shared the blacker side of my sense of humor. Beside me, sketching madly, are three artists from the local TV stations drawing my profile. Behind them are the reporters and the court buffs, all awaiting my reactions upon first being called a murderer in public. At 2 o'clock, Nico enters from the cloakroom, with Molto close behind. Delay is without restraint and goes on answering the questions of reporters who followed him into the little side anteroom. He talks to them through the open door. "The prosecuting attorney," I think to myself. "The fucking PA." Barbara has taken my hand, and with Nico's appearance, she grips it a little tighter. When I first met Nico a dozen years ago, I recognized him instantly as a smart-ass ethnic kid, familiar to me from high school in the streets, the kind who, over the years, I had self-consciously chosen not to be, savvier than he was smart, boastful, always talking. But with few others to look to, I formed with Nico the sort of fast association of fresh recruits. We went to lunch together. We helped each other with briefs. After our first few years, we drifted, a result of our native differences. Having clerked for the Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, I was perceived as lawyerly. Nico, like dozens of deputy PAs for decades past, arrived in the office with his political network already thick. I would listen to him on the telephone. He had been a precinct captain in the organization of his cousin, Emilio Tonetti, a county commissioner who had secured Nico's position, one of the last political hirings Raymond agreed to. Nico knew half the hacks and functionaries in the county building, and he never stopped buying tickets to the political golf outings and dinners and making the rounds. In truth, he proved a better lawyer than was expected. He can write, although he hates to spend time in the library. And he is effective before a jury. His courtroom persona, as I have observed it over the years, is typical of many prosecutors. Humorless, relentless, blandly mean. He has a unique intensity, which I always illustrate by telling what is known as the climax story. I told it last week to Sandy and Kemp when they asked about the last case I tried with DeLaGuardia. That was almost 8 years ago, right after we had been assigned to the felony courts. We were both hungry for jury work, and therefore we agreed to try a dead-bang loser of a rape case on reassignment from somebody smarter. DeLay had the complaining witness, Lucille Fallon, on the witness stand, I told Sandy and Kemp. Lucille, a dark-skinned lady, had been in a bar at 4 in the afternoon when she met the defendant. Her husband, on unemployment, was home with the 4 kids. Lucille got to talking with the defendant, Freddie Mac, and agreed to accept a ride home. Freddie was a 4-time loser with a prior rape and an assault, which the jury, of course, never heard anything about, and he got a little overeager and took a straight edge from his pocket, thereby helping himself to what, by all appearances, was already going to come his way. Hal Lerner had the defendant, and he knocked every black out of the box. So there were 12 middle-aged white people looking over this Negro lady who'd gotten a little rougher treatment than she wanted when she went out to wander. Nico and I spent hours attempting to prepare Lucille for her testimony with no visible result. She looked terrible, a frumpy, fat lady in a tight dress, rambling on about this awful thing that happened to her. Her husband was in the front row, and she laid it on thick, making up an entirely new version of events right in the courtroom. Now she had met Freddie as he was emerging from the tavern and asked her for directions. She was already heading for devastation on Cross when Nico finally began to elicit testimony about the act. "And what did Mr. Mac do then, Mrs. Fallon?"
"He done it."
"What was that, ma'am?"
"What he been saying he do."
"Did he have intercourse with you, Mrs. Fallon?"
"Yes, sir, he done."
"Did he place his sex organ inside yours?"
"Uh-huh."
"And where was the razor?"
Right here on my throat, pressing right there. I thought every time I breathe, he gonna slice me open."
"All right, ma'am." Nico was about to move on when I, seated at counsel table, handed him a note.
"That's right," said Nico, "I forgot."
"Did he have a climax, ma'am?"
"Sir, did he have a climax?"
"No, sir, he be driving a Ford Faylane." DeLay never smiled. Judge Farragut was laughing so hard that he hid under the bench, and one of the jurors literally rolled out of his seat. Nico never even quivered. And after they came back NG, I told Jamie and Sandy, he swore he would never try a case with me again. He said that because I had not managed to keep a straight face, I gave the jury the feeling it wasn't a serious case. Nico is looking happy enough today. The radiance of power hangs around him. He is wearing his carnation again, and he could not possibly carry himself more erect. He looks trim and well turned out in a new dark suit. There is an attractive vitality to him, as he moves back and forth, trading shots with the reporters, mixing answers to serious questions with personal remarks. One thing is for sure, I think, the son of a bitch is enjoying himself at my expense. He is this season's media hero, the man who solved the murder of the year. You cannot pick up a local paper without seeing his face. 2 last week I saw columns suggesting that Nico might try out for the mayoral race 2 years down the line. Nico responded by pledging his fealty to Bolcaro, but you wonder where those columns came from. Nonetheless, Stern has insisted that Nico has endeavored to handle the case fairly. He has talked to the press far more than either of us believes is appropriate, but not all of the leaks have come from him or even Tommy Molto. The police department is beyond its meager capacities for restraint with a case like this. Nico has been candid with Stern about the progress of the investigation. He shared the physical evidence as it developed, and he gave me notice of the indictment. He agreed that I was not a flight risk, and will consent to entry of a signature bond. Most important, perhaps, he has thus far done me the favor of not adding an additional charge of obstruction of justice. It was Stern, during one of our early conferences, who first pointed out the jeopardy I was in, were I to be indicted for willfully concealing facts material to the investigation. "A jury, Rusty, is very likely to believe that you were in that apartment that night, and that at the very least you should have spoken up about it, and certainly not lied in your meeting with Horgan and Molto and Delaguardia and MacDougall. Your conversation with Detective Lepranzer concerning the mud sheets from your home is also very damaging." Stern was matter-of-fact about all this. His cigar was stuck in the corner of his mouth as he spoke. Did his eye flicker up for just an instant? "He's the most subtle man I've met. Somehow I knew why the topic had been raised. Should he go to Nico with that deal? That was what he was asking. I could not get more than 3 years for obstruction of justice. I would be out in 18 months. I would have my son again before he's grown. In 5 years I could probably regain my license to practice law. I have not lost my power to reason, but I cannot overcome the emotional inertia. I want back the life I had, no less. I want this not to be. I do not want to be marked as long as I live. To plead would be the same as conceding to an unneeded amputation. Worse. No plea, I told Sandy.
No, of course not, of course.
He looked at me with disbelief. He had not raised the subject. In the weeks that followed, we assumed that DeLaGuardia would include this surer count in the indictment. In moments of weird buoyancy, particularly in the last weeks when it became clear that charges were being readied, I fantasized that the indictment might be for obstruction alone. Instead, the indictment charged only murder. There are tactical reasons that a prosecutor might make that choice. An obstruction count would offer a tempting, and to a prosecutor, unsatisfying, compromise for a jury inclined to find me guilty but uneasy with the circumstantial nature of Nico's case. But on the day the indictment was returned, Sandy gave me what I found a surprising account of Nico's decision.
"I have spent a good deal of time, of course, speaking with Nico lately," Sandy told me. "He speaks of you and Barbara with some feeling. He has told me on two or three occasions stories of your early days together in the office. Briefs, he says, you wrote for him. Evenings that he enjoyed with the two of you while he was married. I must say, Rusty, that he seems sincere.
Molto is a zealot. He hates every person he prosecutes.
But about Nico, I am not so sure. I believe, Rusty, that he has been deeply affected by this case, and that he made this choice as a matter of fairness.
He has decided that it would be irresponsible to put an end to your professional life simply because you were indiscreet, for whatever reason, and to whatever degree. If you are guilty of this murder, then you must be punished, he thinks. Otherwise, he is content to let you go. And I, for one, applaud him for that.
I believe, said the lawyer, whom I have thus far paid $25,000 to defend me, that is the correct approach.
Criminal case 86-1246, calls out Alvin, Judge Mumphrey's handsome black docket clerk. My stomach sinks, and I head up toward the podium. Jamie is behind me. Judge Mumphrey, who entered only a moment ago, is getting settled on the bench. The cynics sometimes explain Ed's ascension to Chief Judge as a function of his good looks. He was an elected judiciary's concession to the media age, someone whom voters would think of with comfort when they face the judge's retention ballot. Ed's appearance is wonderfully judicial, with fine silver hair drawn straight back from the brow and features regular and yet sharp enough to be stern. He is asked a couple of times each year to pose for one of the bar journals in some piece of advertising. DeLaGuardia ends up standing beside me. Molto is a few feet behind. As good as Nico looks, Tommy is a disheveled mess. His vest, absurd by itself in July, has ridden upon his substantial belly, and his shirt sleeves stick too far out of his jacket. His hair has not been combed. Now that I've seen Molto, the impulse to call him a twerp, which I thought I would have to stifle, has passed. Instead, I seek to look Nico in the eye. He nods.
Rusty, he says simply.
Delay, I answer. When I look down toward his waist, I see that he has covertly offered his hand. I do not have a chance to test the full extent of my charity. Kemp has caught hold of my coat sleeve and jerks it violently to pull me aside. He comes to stand between DeLaGuardia and me. We both know that I do not have to be told not to talk to the prosecutors. Judge Mumphrey from the walnut bench looks down and smiles at me circumspectly before he speaks. I appreciate the recognition. This is criminal case 86-1246. Let me ask counsel to identify themselves for the record. Your Honor, I am Nico Della Guardia, on behalf of the people of the state. With me is Chief Deputy District Attorney Thomas Molto. Funny the things that get you. I cannot suppress the briefest sound when I hear my title with Molto's name. Kemp jerks my sleeve again. Quentin Kemp, Your Honor, of Alejandro Stern, P.C., on behalf of the defendant, Rojat K. Savage, I would request leave, Your Honor, to file our appearance. Jamie's motion is allowed, and the court records now officially indicate that Stern and company are my lawyers. Jamie then moves on. Your Honor, the defendant is present in court. We would acknowledge receipt of indictment 86-1246 and waive formal reading. In behalf of Mr. Savage, Your Honor, we would ask the court to enter a plea of not guilty to the charge. Plea of not guilty to the indictment, repeats Judge Mumphrey, making a note on the court record. Bail is set by agreement as a $50,000 signature bond. Is there a request from either party for pretrial conference? This is the plea bargaining session, usually an automatic, since it helps both sides buy time. Delay starts to speak, but Kemp interrupts. Your Honor, such a meeting would be an unnecessary waste of the court's time. He looks down at his legal pad for the words that Sandy wrote. When Kemp gets outside, he will read the same speech again live for the TV minicam teams. The charges in this case are very grave, and they are entirely false. The reputation of one of the city's finest public servants and attorneys has been impugned, and perhaps destroyed, with no basis in fact. In the truest sense of the words, justice in this case must be swift, and we ask the court, therefore, to set an immediate trial date. The rhetoric is splendid, but tactics, of course, govern this demand. Sandy has emphasized to me that a quick disposition will avoid interminable strain on my shattered emotions. But disordered though I may be, I recognize the fundamental rationale. Time is with the prosecutor in this case. Delay's principal evidence will not deteriorate. My fingerprints will not lose their memory. The mud records will not die. With time, the PA's case can only become stronger. A witness from the scene might appear. There may be some account of what happened to the murder weapon. Kemp's request is a significant departure from form, since most defendants view delay as a second-best alternative to acquittal. Our demand seems to catch Nico and Molto short. Again, De La Guardia starts to speak, but Judge Mumphrey interrupts. For whatever reason, he has heard enough. The defendant has waived pretrial conference. The matter will therefore be set over immediately for trial. Mr. Clerk, he says, please draw a name. About 5 years ago, after a scandal in the clerk's office, the last chief judge, Foley, solicited suggestions on a method to ensure that the selection of a trial judge for a lawsuit was completely random. I came up with the idea that the draw be made in court, in front of everybody. The proposal, put forth, of course, in Horgan's name, was immediately adopted, and I believe was the touchstone for Raymond's belief that I had executive ability. Now, wooden plaques, each bearing the name of a judge, are spun inside a closed cage borrowed from a bingo game. Alvin, the clerk, rolls the bones, as they are known. He pulls the first into the opening. Judge Little, he says. Laren Little. Raymond's old partner. The defense lawyer's dream. I am lightheaded. Kemp reaches back and with no other movement squeezes my hand. Molto actually groans. I am pleased to see that up on the bench Judge Mumphrey for an instant seems to smile. The case will be set down to Judge Little's docket for motions and trial. Defendant's motions to be filed in 14 days, the prosecuting attorney to respond according to Judge Little's order. Judge Mumphrey picks up his gavel. He is about to move on, but looks down at Nico for a moment. Mr. De La Guardia, I should have interrupted Mr. Kemp, but I suppose this case is likely to inspire many speeches by the time that it concludes. I do not mean to endorse what he said, but he is correct when he observes that these are very serious charges. Against a lawyer who I think we all know has served this court with distinction for many years. Let me say to you, sir, simply, that I, like all other citizens of this county, hope that in this case that justice will be done, and has been done. Ed Mumfrey nods again to me, and the next case is called. DeLaGuardia leaves as he came, through the cloakroom exit. Kemp is straining to maintain a straight face. Jamie puts his pad in his briefcase and watches Nico go.
"He walks pretty well, doesn't he?" asks Jamie, "with all that sticking out his behind."
Chapter 20. "I take it," Barbara says, "that you're very pleased about Laren." We were on the highway now, finally free of the downtown traffic. Barbara is behind the wheel. We have learned in recent weeks that my distraction is such that the world is not safe when I drive. There is a primitive relief with the cameras and the clamor behind us. The press pack followed us from the courthouse, down the street, snapping pictures, the huge video cameras lurching toward us like some monster's eyes. We walked slowly. "Try," Sandy urged us earlier, "to look relaxed." We left Kemp at a corner two blocks on. "If every day goes like this one," he said, "Nico won't get past opening statement." Jamie, by nature, is a cheerful soul, but somehow his bonhomie conjured a shadow. Every day will not be like this one. Grimmer moments are ahead. I shook his hand and told him he was a pro. Barbara kissed him on the cheek. "Laren is a good draw," I say. "The best, probably." I hesitate only because of Raymond. Neither he nor Judge Little would ever communicate outside of court about the case, but the presence of the judge's best friend as a witness is bound to have some impact, one way or the other, depending on the balance of Raymond's sympathies. I touch Barbara's hand on the wheel. "I appreciate your being there." "I don't mind," she says. "Really, it was very interesting," she adds, sincere as ever in her curiosity, "if you don't consider the circumstances." Mine is what the lawyers call a high-profile case. The press attention will continue to be intense. In that situation, communication with the eventual jurors begins long before they come to court for jury service. Nico has been winning the press battles so far. I have to do what I can to project a positive image. Since I am charged, in essence, with murder and adultery, it is important that the public believe that my wife has not lost faith in me. Barbara's attendance at every event the media will cover is critical. Stern insisted that she come downtown so that he could explain this to her face to face. Given her distaste for public occasions, her narrow suspicions of outsiders, I expected her to regard this as a taxing assignment. But she has not resisted. Her support in the last 2 months has been unfailing. While she continues to view me as the victim of my own follies, this time for having ever been enamored of public life and cutthroat politics, she recognizes that things have passed well beyond the stage where I am being served right. She regularly expresses confidence in my vindication, and without a word from me, presented me with a $50,000 cashier's check to cover Sandy's retainer and the later fees, which was drawn from a trust which her father left exclusively in her control. She has listened with fast attention to hours of table conversation, in which I lambaste Nico and Molto, or describe the intricacies of little strategies that Stern has devised. In the evenings, when I am apt to recede to a withdrawn vacancy, she will come to stroke my hand. She has taken on some of my suffering. Although she evinces bravery, I know that there are moments, alone, when she has cried. Not only the stress of these extraordinary events, but the radical alteration of my schedule has added a new tempo to our relations. I journey to the library, draft notes for my defense, root pointlessly in the garden. But we are alone together now much of the time. With the summer, Barbara has few responsibilities at the U, and we linger over breakfast after I drop Nat off for camp. At lunch, I go out and pick greens for our salad. And a new sexual languor has moved softly into our relationship. "I was thinking we should do it," she announced one afternoon from the sofa, where she was reclining with obscure reading material and Belgian chocolates. Thus, an afternoon encounter has become part of our new routine. It is easiest for her to come crouched over me, hunkered down. The birds sing outside the windows, The daylight seeps beyond the edges of the bedroom blinds. Barbara rolls around with my pin driven deep inside her, that muscular vortex at work, her eyes closed but rolling, her face otherwise serene as her hue increases and she works toward the point of release. Barbara is an imaginative, athletic lover. It was not sensual deprivation which drove me to Carolyn. I cannot complain about hang-ups or fetishes or what Barbara will not do. Even in the worst of our times, even amid the upheaval that followed my idiotic confessions last winter, sex was not abandoned. We are of the revolutionary generation. We spoke openly of sexuality. When we were young, we tended it like a magic lantern, and we continued to find its place. We have become expert in the physiognomy of pleasure, the nodes to press, the points to massage. Barbara, a woman of the 80s, would find it a further insult to do without. For the time being, the clinical aspect which inhabited our relations for months is gone. But even now I find something desperate and sad in Barbara's loving. There are distances yet left to cross. I lie in bed in the sweet afternoons while Barbara dozes, the midday suburban quiet soothing and beguiling after years of downtown racket, and consider the mystery to me that is my wife. Even at the zenith of my passion for Carolyn, I gave no thought to leaving. If my marriage to Barbara at times has been equivocal, our family life has not. We both dote relentlessly on Nat. I grew up knowing that other families lived differently from mine. They spoke across the dinner table. They went together to the movies and soda fountains. I saw them running, playing ball in the open fields of the public forest. I yearned. They shared a life. Our existence as a family, as parents and child, is the single aspiration of my childhood that I feel I have fulfilled. The only wound of that time I have healed. And yet, to pretend that Nathaniel is our sole salvation is too cynical, pessimistic, false. Even in the grimmest period, we both respond to the inner commandments that find some value here. My wife is an attractive woman, extremely so. She minds the mirror carefully, assuming certain predetermined angles to be sure she remains intact. Her bust line still peaked, the waist, notwithstanding pregnancy, still girlish. Her dark, precise features not yet losing fineness in any gathering of adipose, or slackening from beneath the jaw. She could certainly find suitors. She chooses not to. She is an able woman. And on her father's death, $100,000 was placed in trust for her, so that it is not need which keeps her from departing. For better or for worse, there must be truth in the bitter words that she will sometimes hurl at me in the heat of quarrels. That I am the only one, the one person, save Nat, whom she has ever loved. In the clement periods, as now, Barbara's devotion is apt to be extreme. She is eager to have me absorb her attentions. I become her ambassador to the outside world, bringing back to Nearing observations and stories. When I am on trial, I will frequently arrive home at 11 p.m. or midnight to find Barbara waiting in her housecoat, my dinner warm. We sit together, and she listens with her intense, abstracted curiosity to what has taken place that day, much like a 30s child before the radio. The dishes clank, I speak with my mouth full, and Barbara laughs and marvels about the witnesses, the cops, the lawyers, whom she sees only through me. And for me, what is there? Certainly I value loyalty and commitment, kindness and attention, when they are shown. Her instance of selfless love, so focused upon me, are balm for my abraded ego. But it would be phony and hollow if I were to claim that there are not also moments when I despise her. The injured son of an angry man, I cannot fully master my vulnerabilities to her blackish moods. In her fits of lacerating sarcasm, I feel my hands twitch with the impulse toward strangulation. In response to these periods, I have taught myself to manifest an indifference, which, over time, has begun to become real. We stumble into a sickening cycle, a tug of war in which we are each maneuvering for position by forever stepping back. But those times are far off now, and almost forgiven. We wait instead on the brink of discovery. What is it that holds me? Some yearning. In the languid afternoons, I seem almost to seize it, even while the doors and windows of my soul are thrown open to a fundamental gratitude. We have never been without momentary eruptions. Barbara is incapable of long-term serenity. But we have also made our trips to the brightest spots and highest places. With Barbara Bernstein, I certainly have known the finest moments of my life. The first years were innocent, spirited, full of that clamorous passion and a sense of mystery that exceeds what can be described. I long at times, in transported recollection, I pine. I perish with a groping sensation. I am like some misbegotten thing left at the end of science fiction adventures, which reels about with stumps outstretched, beckoning toward the creatures of which it was once one. Let me in again. Unwork time. When I was in the law school at the U, Barbara was teaching. We lived in a 2.5-room apartment, ancient, vermin-ridden, in scandalous disrepair. The radiators shot out streams of boiling water in the middle of the winter. The mice and roaches claimed as their own domain any cabinet space below the level of the sink. Only because it was considered student quarters did this home escape categorization as what was then called slum housing. Our landlords were two Greeks, a husband and a wife, one sicker than the other. They lived a floor above and across the courtyard. We could hear his emphysemic eruptions in any season. Her problem was arthritis and degenerative diseases of the heart. I dreaded bringing up the rent each month because the odor of decay, a dense, foreign, rotting smell, something like cabbage, that came into the air as soon as their door opened. But it was all that we could afford. With my tuition deducted from a starting teacher's salary, we approached the bureaucratic standards for recognized poverty. We had a standing joke that we were so poor that the only form of entertainment we could afford was fucking. This humor was more in the nature of shared embarrassment, for we knew that we verged on the excessive. Those were sensuous years. The end of the week was something I would drag myself toward. We made our own kind of Sabbath, dinner alone, a bottle of wine, and then lovely, long, ambling amours. We could start anywhere around the apartment, and move, in growing dishabille, across the rug and toward the bedroom. This would sometimes go on for more than an hour, me aching and priapic, and my dark little beauty, her breasts tipped in ecstasy, as we lolled and meandered over one another. And it was one night like this, as I led Barbara toward the final steps into the bedroom, that I saw our blind was open, and above, our two elderly neighbors, their faces toward the window, were watching. There was something so starstruck and innocent about their expressions that in recollection they appeared to me like startled animals, does, rabbits, a look of uncomprehending, round-eyed wonder. I never suspected them of having spied for long, a feeling which in no way eased my shame. I stood there with my erect member at that instant in Barbara's palm, which was wet with almond oil. Barbara saw them too, I know. Because as I drew back and started toward the blind, she stopped me. She touched my hand, and then she took hold of me again. "Don't look," she said. "Don't look," she murmured, her breath sweet and warm on my face. "They're almost gone." Chapter 21 1 week after my arraignment, Sandy and I stand together in the reception area of the law firm in which Raymond Horgan has been a partner since May. A very classy affair. The floor is parquet, covered by one of the largest Persian rugs I've ever seen, rose hues on a vibrant navy field. Lots of expensive-looking abstract art is on the walls, and glass and chrome end tables are set at each corner of the room, with copies of Forbes and the Wall Street Journal laid out in ranks. A sweet blonde, who probably gets an extra couple of grand a year for being so good-looking, is behind a fancy rosewood desk taking names. Sandy has hold of my lapel in the lightest way, instructing me in a murmur. The young lawyers who hustle by in their shirt sleeves probably cannot even see his lips move. I am not to hold a discussion, Sandy says. He will ask the questions. My presence is intended, as he puts it, merely as a stimulant. Above all, he says, I am to remain collected, whatever the climate of our reception. Do you know something? I ask.
One hears things, Sandy says. Speculation is pointless when we will so soon know answers firsthand.
Sandy, in fact, hears many things. A good defense lawyer has an intricate network. Clients bring information, reporters. Sometimes there are cops who are friends, not to mention other defense lawyers. When I was a prosecutor, the defense bar seemed to be a kind of tribe, always on their tom-toms whenever there was any piece of news that they could properly communicate. Sandy has told me that DeLaGuardia subpoenaed Horgan to the grand jury right after Nico took office, and that Raymond tried to resist on grounds of executive privilege. Sandy knows this, he has said, from an excellent source. Given this skirmishing, I would expect continuing hostility between Raymond and Nico, but Sandy's reaction when he saw Raymond's name on the witness list implies other knowledge. Sandy, of course, would never betray the confidence of whoever it is who gave him a notion of Raymond's intentions. Horgan's secretary comes out to retrieve us, and halfway to his office, Raymond himself is there. He is in his shirt sleeves, without his coat. Sandy, Rusty, he claps me once briefly on the shoulder as he shakes my hand. He has put on more weight, and his gut is straining against the lower buttons on his shirt. Have you fellows ever been up here? Raymond takes us on a tour. With the incentives of the tax code, the law firms and corporations have become the new